Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Sean Cisterna, a writer, director, and producer whose films include Moon Point, Full Out, and the quietly devastating Kiss and Cry. His latest, From the Vine, stars Joe Pantoliano, Paola Brancati, and Marco Leonardi, and it's available on digital and on demand this Friday, July 10th. Sean picked Life is Beautiful, Roberto Benigni's 1997 smash about a man trying to spare his young son from the horrors of the Holocaust by telling him the whole thing is an elaborate game. Backed by the Miramax machine at its peak, the film won the Grand Prix at Cannes, took the People's Choice Award at TIFF, and rolled straight on into awards season. Nominated for 7 Oscars, it won 3, Best Foreign Language Film, Best Original Score, and, of course, Best Actor. It was a different time, but Sean loves it, so here he is to talk about it. This is Someone Else's Movie.
Okay, well, there's a sense of dread going into this, knowing that you don't particularly like this choice of film. So it's you know that feeling when you get when you are so excited about a film and then you're about to tell your friend and your friend doesn't respond the same way. So that's the impending dread I feel going into this podcast right now.
I have been there once or twice. Yeah, it's okay. The very first episode of this podcast was Anne Donahue on American Hustle, which she picked because she knew I hated it. I think the theory was that if we could get through that, I could do an episode on anything.
Right.
Okay. I don't know that I despise Life is Beautiful on the same level. I just felt like when I was sitting there in the theater in 99 that I saw through it. And we can absolutely address my concerns with Benigni as a storyteller, which is, I think, where it comes in.
Okay.
But yeah, more importantly, tell me why you love it.
Yeah.
Not in an adversarial way.
No, just... no. Well, I don't know. I was, I was never the most popular guy at school. So unrequited love was sort of my jam in high school. So, when I first got a girlfriend, and this was the first foreign film that I ever took, a date to, so it was a lot was riding on it, and it ended up being this magical experience that we both undertook, and we witnessed a charming clown who did everything for the benefit of his wife and his young son. So we witnessed a sacrificial moment in film, and for that, I look back and it always resonates as an important piece of work for me. I mean, it starts off very grim and obviously very foggy. You know, Guido, the Benigni character, is walking through this thick fog and comes across what we later discover will be a pile of bodies in this atrocity that happens in our history. But and I just remember the opening voiceover. This unseen narrator says this is a simple story and not an easy one to tell. So. And then it just jump cuts to this bright, sunny, optimistic view of Italy and Benigni traveling through on a car and where the brakes don't work, and it ends up going into this comedy. So I just love how the script is told in, like, you could almost take the film and cut it in half and it's like two separate movies. It starts off as this joyous romantic comedy, and then the second half is obviously very grim and dark. So I love that about it as well.
Yeah, we saw it at TIFF after it had played Cannes, so it arrived here as the Roberto Benigni Holocaust movie, so maybe that was it. The clouds were already over it, to my mind. And I had interviewed Benigni and Nicoletta Braschi when they came through town with Johnny Stecchino. Mm-hmm. And that movie is about a charming man who is mistaken for a mobster and then used in an elaborate scam and also falls in love with Nicoletta Braschi, because that's how Roberto Benigni writes his movies. He wants the two of them. The way he explained it was, the audience in Italy already knows that when the two of us are together, we will fall in love. So all of their movies are about that. What I actually like about Life is Beautiful is he gets the romance right up front, that it's not, the question isn't whether or not they will fall for each other. It's, that is a given, to the point where it's just a given. It's not even something they go through the motions of. I mean, his courtship is portrayed as adorable and whimsical and lovely, but she's the movie has no doubt that these two are going to get together, because that's not what the movie is really about.
Yeah. So you went in with that. You went in with that lens. Like, I didn't know that. I was 18 at the time, and I didn't know much about Italian film history. So
99, I would have been 31 and much more cynical.
Yeah.
but also the in between Johnny Stecchino and Life is Beautiful, he made a film called The Monster, Il Mostro, where he plays a man who is mistaken for being a rapist and a murderer. And it felt in that film, which I did not like, Johnny Stecchino's fine, but I did not like The Monster. It felt like he was just trying to find a more unpleasant and grating story to make a comedy out of. And, you know, he follows his muse. That's how it works. And having done it in Il Mostro, he decided to find an even more difficult subject matter to turn into romance and comedy. And that's Life is Beautiful, because, you know, what is harder to do than the Holocaust? And I don't know that he did it consciously. I don't know that that was, you know, I'm sure he didn't think of it as, this is going to get me an Academy Award or make me an international name. He was already pretty much an international name, just had a much, much larger audience in Italy than he did outside of it. But his films played, like Miramax picked them up and distributed them, and he was not unknown. But Life is Beautiful to me just... I'm trying to figure out how to articulate it. It's the sort of storytelling that gets my back up, because it has this weird veiled superiority. And maybe it would be different if Benigni hadn't cast himself and had let someone else play the role. But this larger sense of mine, that he's just kind of in it as a self-aggrandizing performer, that he stacks the odds in a way that makes it certain that he will have a tragic, like his victory will be tragic, and that his deception will prevail. We'll have to go into the ending. This is a Holocaust movie. Yeah. I kept wondering what the point of it all was, and then stylizing, you know, the deaths of hundreds of people within the film, and, you know, millions by extension, that he's using it all as a backdrop for his antic spirit and love of life. And it just felt tone deaf to me in a way that didn't sit well. And the longer I spent in the movie, the more impatient I was with it.
Right.
Because how many times does Guido need to show us, or does Benigni need to show us how much of a genius Guido is, and how fanciful he is, and how lively and amusing he is? And, you know, I started thinking that this film only works if the Nazi characters are just as gentle and silly. And a couple of them are indulgent and a couple of them are not. But, you know, to make this movie after Schindler's List demonstrated that it is possible to convey the true horror of World War II and the camps with a story that works in the middle of it by not backing away, by just full on demonstrating how terrible the conditions were, you can still tell an uplifting story, and you can still find, I think there is a way to tell the story of Life is Beautiful in a way that suits the tension, and that, you know, death is around every corner, and saying the wrong thing will get people killed, or showing any kind of resistance will just simply end someone's life. That's missing from Life is Beautiful, because he's trying to convey it as fantasy, as a memory. But what that's telling me as well is that he hasn't thought through the larger implications of the story he's telling, and that this child's memories are not that bad. Like, the point of this fable is, it's a difficult story to tell, but I have really lovely memories of the concentration camps because my dad tried really hard. If someone told you that story, you would look at them like they were insane. And that's the disconnect that I find, that it's just in the service of each individual liberty he takes with the story makes sense within the world of the film. But if you step out for a moment, the way the film almost does when Guido finds the bodies and we're allowed to take it in, but the person telling the story wouldn't know that. The person telling that story was literally protected from that reality, and Guido died before he could have ever told it. Mm-hmm. So that little thing, those tiny little things that tell me that Benigni's not really as invested in this story as he wants us to believe he is. And then in the end, and I guess the thing that's made it worse for me now is that the film was suddenly swept up in the much-loved campaign of 1999, where it became a front runner somehow for Best Foreign Language Film, and he won Best Actor, and all of that. And that's part of that is, of course, the Miramax machine is Harvey Weinstein throwing money at a thing that he thought was a winner, because he was the best at that. culminates in Benigni literally standing on Steven Spielberg's chair, which is the greatest metaphor I can think of, right? Because that's the only way this movie works. And it just, it was one of those things where I felt like no one else could see what I saw. And I get the, you know, especially if you're younger, the intensity of the emotion and the way that the music works to just sort of push past all of these problems. I get it. I understand that working for people, but I felt like I was the only one, yeah, who had a couple of questions. And then just, you know, over what, 20 odd years, I've had plenty of time to stew in it.
Yeah. So perhaps, I mean, it sounds like you're taking a lot of your own, perhaps, I don't want to use the word cynicism, but perhaps you are.
Oh, baggage. I'm perfectly happy to say. Yeah.
Yeah. And it seems like a lot of the issues you have with the film are, you know, maybe outside of the film itself. So Benigni himself as a person or his past work and has an influence on the way you see the film.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think...
is that fair, though?
Especially,
is that fair?
Well, especially since the film is sold on Benigni, I think so. I mean, he is the auteur here. He writes, he directs, he stars. He makes absolutely sure there is a continuity of character in all of the films he plays. There are always people who are wrongly accused or unfairly imprisoned or fingered for something that they didn't do. In this case, you know, Guido's not even Jewish. He's just...
No, it's the other way around. He is Jewish. She is not.
Okay. So, yeah. There you go. Yeah. This is, unfortunately, I did not revisit this as recently as I wanted to. I watched it again a little while ago when I was a guest on Jeremy Lalonde's podcast, Black Hole Films, which was the first one I ever did. And he brought me in to just sort of puncture the movie for the people who'd watched it, for Eric Johnson and Jess Greco, who both really liked it. And then I showed up and just said, nah.
Okay. But, you know, I guess in studying, you know, I was a film student at the time, so we were studying screenwriting. And what I love about the script is the callbacks that happen in the first half of the film and then are, you know, later repeated with great significance afterwards. So
sure.
I don't know if you recall, like the young boy, Joshua, you know, he was set up right away as not wanting to have a shower. You know, he put his foot down. No, I'm not dirty. I don't want to have a shower. And then obviously that pays off to great significance later in the film where, you know, had he gone to have a shower, had he liked showers, then that would have ended up in his total doom. So I did love the way that those initial things that were scripted paid off in a significant way later on. And, you know, for my young filmmaker brain, that was a great way of writing story, that payoffs that happened at the beginning that also occur later in the film.
Yeah, he's good at structure. He is. Mm-hmm. I mean, the film pays off on all of its promises, and it's, I don't want you to feel that I'm trying to bring you around either. You're totally allowed to love what you love. But I guess maybe it's simply that, I mean, I really wonder if it is that simple, if it's just that I'd seen his other movies and he does exactly the same thing in each of them. The only difference is in Life is Beautiful that his character doesn't survive.
Right.
That he's the martyr.
Yeah. So for me, why I picked this film was because, you know, what we're currently going through, this pandemic is, you know, me as a dad to three young kids, like it's, I find these parallels that are happening from that film into what we're going through now. So these, you know, my kids are forced to cut off all contact with their friends and they can't go to school and everything's closed. And it's a very dire situation, obviously, with the present state of the world, you know, even though it's, you know, slowly getting better and restrictions are easing. It's just that time where it first started, my wife and I had to think on our feet pretty quick and try to make this a fun experience for these kids who were wondering why the world was going to hell.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. Like the idea that there are real world analogies for this right now. So what did you, what did you do? How did you entertain?
Just said this pandemic is wonderful. You know, it allows us to spend all this time together. We're going to do so many more family activities. And, you know, slowly our energy level waned a little bit as the days and weeks went on. So we weren't as joyous as Guido might have been towards his young son. But no, we tried to make the pandemic a time to, you know, work on crafts and bond as a family and watch films together. So it's kind of been, you know, in a strange way, kind of nice to spend that time together. And they, they love coronavirus. They don't want the coronavirus to go away because now it's summertime and they can play outside and not go to school. So I don't know. I think we sheltered them from the, you know, perhaps the harsh reality of what was going on around the world. But, you know, maybe they're a little too young to understand and fully appreciate what a time in history this is for the world. But yeah, we tried to make it shelter them slightly so that they their outcome was a little more positive than, you know, negative as to what their parents might have thought.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean, again, that is the central theme, really, of Life is Beautiful, is that hiding your terror from your own family, mm-hmm. from your own children, to give them the sense that everything is going to be okay, which I guess is the base job of any parent. But how did you handle your own stress? I mean, I don't have kids, and I was quietly freaking out plenty in March and April.
Yeah, I remember we were supposed to record this back then, and you're like,
oh, yes, that's
maybe,
right.
Maybe don't come over now. it was a difficult time for sure. My own stress, I don't know. I think as a parent, you know, if you ensure that your kids are feeling okay, that is a little bit reassuring. It feels like you're doing the right job. But no, we would quietly freak out at night when the kids were in bed, and that's when the news would go on, and we'd watch all these, you know, sad atrocities, these medical atrocities happening all over the world. So,
yeah, it's just been. I was going to say something clever about how the Holocaust would have been very different if they'd had the internet, but I'm pretty sure it would be exactly the same.
Yeah,
We haven't changed. We're seeing it happening right now in slow motion. Nothing is different.
And I do get like the criticisms. I know like Benigni's been criticized for softening the Holocaust, and you know, I think there are two ways to look at it. I mean, yes, the Holocaust was obviously an atrocity that happened during the 1940s or late 30s and 40s. But can you step aside and view this as not necessarily a Holocaust film, but more of a film about human triumph and the power of imagination? You know, I guess it depends on how you grew up. I know there are some Jewish friends of mine don't see the film the way I do, but I know a lot of Jewish people do as well. I mean, Benigni worked with the Jewish Center in Milan, I believe, when he was working on the film and on the script and consulting and doing as much as research as he can, even though he's a Gentile, right? Mm-hmm. He still did his homework. I mean, I don't think this is a film that could be made today. I with cultural appropriation being in the forefront, I don't think Life is Beautiful could be made by a non-Jew in today's world. So I don't know. It's an interesting slice of life. Created in a period where this was allowed, you know, even though it may not be allowed today.
Yeah, I do wonder about that too. I think that on some level, and this is something that's come up a few times in the past with films, that simply making a movie about the subject is presumed to be worthy. Like just the fact that this is a film about a thing that an audience has a specific interest in. I mean, my parents who were both born, well, during World War II, actually, in the early 40s, grew up with the Holocaust. Like they are, both of my parents are Jewish, and I guess technically I am too, although I don't really practice at all. Both of my parents grew up steeped in the dread of the Holocaust, you know, never again, all of that. And the idea that people were suddenly making movies about the Holocaust in the 80s and 90s, when it really started to pick up as a theme, as a topic, that was perceived as just a net positive. And the idea that that you could qualitatively evaluate them within the Holocaust genre, that was not an issue. It wasn't important. It was more important that the message was getting out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got for Schindler's List in the Gray Zone on one side, and then you've got Life is Beautiful and maybe The Boy in the Striped Pajamas on the other. And the Boy in the Striped Pajamas probably wouldn't exist without Life is Beautiful having already demonstrated that the sort of middle ground Holocaust movie that doesn't really, really go deep into the specifics, details, the misery of it, and treats it more metaphorically or allegorically was possible. But I just, in those cases, it just feels like the territory has been mined
to better purpose, I guess. But that, again, this is just me refusing to budge, which is unfair to you.
Yeah, that's okay. I don't mind like going back and forth like this. It's not going to soften my love for the film, like, as I do look at it more of as a joyous piece of cinema. You know, when I look back at the film, I love the structure as well. So like you mentioned earlier that Benigni was great at structure, and we talked about how the film opens as almost a romantic comedy, and all these tropes that happen with Guido trying to woo his you know future wife Dora, you know, all these magical elements, and her falling from the sky into his arms, and he is established right away as sucking the beasting venom out of her leg. So if you don't set up Guido as this charming, quirky clown, you know, it's very necessary for him. I know he's over the top, and people that might rub a lot of first-time viewers the wrong way if you don't know much about Benigni, but without that clown, that Chaplin-esque charm at the beginning of the film, like the second half wouldn't have paid off as greatly. Like we wouldn't have understood that he had those skills to be able to, you know, pay off and make this Holocaust thing a game for his son. So I think, you know, I totally understand how his joie de vivre and his outlook on life is big and boisterous. And like I said, it may rub people the wrong way, but it's absolutely necessary for when the second half of the film kicks in.
Yeah, and I think I'm giving too short a shrift to Nicoletta Bracci, who as Dora is wonderful. Like she's Benigni even as an actor, I can't really fault him. He is doing exactly what that character needs to do, and he's pitched at the right level. And the idea that, you know, he can be as boisterous as he is on screen and have other people just not run away is a question of tone that he actually manages to achieve. He solves that problem, and you know, Bracci relates to him like he's a real person rather than a man in a clown suit. And that's hugely important, and something that I always sort of push aside the actual accomplishments of the film just because it's come to represent something that I don't really approve of.
Yeah.
But yeah, that first hour is pretty good. It's sweet and it's gentle and delicate, and you know, it doesn't go full on Garden of the Finzi Continis with the clouds gathering around them, but you can feel that it won't last as well, which is something else that I think tonally he accomplishes. Yeah,
there's an impending dread throughout the film, certainly. There's you know, the spray paint on the shop, Guido's shop, that says, you know, this is Jewish store, and then certainly the painting of the horse, the uncle's horse, and labeling it as a Jewish horse. So there are these, you know, you don't get a lot of sense of the Holocaust in the first half of the film, but there are like these hints that pop out. Even one of the minor characters has sons named Benito and Adolfo.
It's like
these references to what's going to change in the Italian political sphere as the film emerges. So
And I remember hearing those and thinking, oh, that's, of course there were kids named that. Those names weren't destroyed yet. They weren't forever associated with, you know, murderous dictators.
That's true.
It's the little things that land much harder culturally within the film, I think, than they would have for me in 99 even. But the sense that he's thought this stuff through, it is a cheap laugh, but it's also a really valid one. It's the sort of gag that catches in your throat when you realize what it really means, which those kind of those don't go away in the second half, but they get more strident, they get more obvious because the stakes are established. And that's where, again, that's where I start kind of resisting the film.
Okay.
Because, you know, they're in a place with lice and typhus and misery and death. And the idea that, malnourishment's not that bad, and, you know, they're managing, that they're getting along. The other problem I have with that is, of course, that I'm reading that as Benigni's own indulgence, which is the subtle suggestion that, well, you know, everybody else could have tried a little harder too. And that's just, you know, that's the problem I have with most of the Holocaust films that end with a victory of any kind. With the exception of Schindler's List, because it shows you just how hard won that victory was. I mean, yeah, it goes a little overboard with the speeches, but it's about what it takes out of people to survive. And this is, okay, Guido doesn't come out, but he also doesn't die on camera. He, you know, that's the directorial touch that, that I find throughout the film to be a little self-serving. Like, it's as though Benigni just can't handle the idea that he might have to show himself die on camera or sustain injury or he creates, it's a self-mythologizing thing in a weird way. You know, not only was my father, the greatest and cleverest and most romantic man, but he also saved me from Nazis. And for all I know, he's still alive somewhere.
Right.
Running around in the night like the shadow.
Yeah, I guess, well, that's the, you know, even Schopenhauer's philosophy is like represented throughout the film or referenced in the film, right? So Schopenhauer was famous for the will to live. And that's even quoted in the film at times. I mean, you know, so
a triumph of the will, if you will.
Yeah, right. So it's following that that theme of beauty and turning the world into having a positive spin on the outlook on life to give you that will to live. And it's obviously the film borrows from the concepts of Schopenhauer and the idea that the internal can be focused on to produce, you know, results. And for the scene, Guido was talking to his friend Ferruccio, and I think I wrote down the quote somewhere. My writing is very messy, but
that's okay.
They're talking about Schopenhauer says that willpower, you can do anything. I am what I want to be. Right now I want to sleep, so I'm saying sleeping, and I fall asleep. So I just love how he can conquer or use Schopenhauer's philosophy to his own benefit and causing Nicoletta Braschi to look at him and using his fingers, and the power of will to make things happen for him is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, on that reading, he gets what he wants. He does. He saves their child, and
yeah, and it's that simple, Norm. That's how simple life can be if you just will it.
Right? Yes. So it's about the secret. Is that what they called it?
The
book, the power of positive thinking.
I don't know. Well, how do you? I need to ask you now that have you here. What is a joyous film for you? Like, what do you find to be a joyous triumph of the human spirit?
Well, my default is always Galaxy Quest, which is a little facetious in this case.
Or is it by nature? Like, do critics have to? You know,
I wonder. Actually, yeah, I was going
to
say
are not allowed to feel joy.
I think the movies that I gravitate to that are positive and uplifting experiences tend to have a lot of darkness in them. Like the first thing I thought of after Galaxy Quest was, weirdly enough, another movie from 1999 was Magnolia, where it's about the tiniest shred of hope coming through. It's the crocus in the ash, right? It's the sense that everything doesn't have to be as bad as it is if we just commit to being better people, better versions of ourselves. So a lot of my stuff is, a lot of the things that make me happy are movies where people really get put through the ringer.
3 hours worth of that.
Magnolia. Definitely. It's weirdly enough, and I was also going to suggest The Right Stuff, which is 3 hours of people putting themselves through absolute hell in order to do something that isn't that important, really, but it is to them. I mean, historically, you could argue that, but the whole movie is, you know, that movie is about a race between one pilot to break the sound barrier and then do it again, and then a bunch of other pilots to simply be mannequins for giant machinery. And in both cases, they commit fully to their purpose. My uplift is more like people who survive extreme, either psychological or physical ordeals and come out the other side as better people. Gravity, Moonlight, things that I can't imagine doing myself, but then somehow I can connect to, I can relate to. I'm trying to think about others. I mean, Lawrence of Arabia and Jaws are two of my favorite movies, and they're about individuals overcoming impossible odds, I guess, if you want to boil them absolutely down to that.
But they're not like joyous films. You don't like smile through them and have a lovely, like, the ending, sure. Like there's a cathartic experience.
Oh, you come out on a huge high.
But Gravity, you're stressed the whole time. And like seeing The Right Stuff, you're stressed and full of tension the whole time, but
maybe that's it. You know, like it's the what is it, the BDSM thing? It feels so good when it stops.
Okay,
that might be my problem.
That's okay. Yeah, well, I love like seeing how different people like experience films different ways. So we're both bringing our own family baggage, I guess, to the
absolutely,
the
films,
and they reflect on each other different ways. So I don't. That's why I don't mind like discussing this film with you, because it's not going to change my viewpoint. But it's
very absolutely. Yeah, no, this isn't supposed to be an adversarial conversation at all. I'm trying to think of other stuff. I mean, you know, I love. This is, again, a film that you would not necessarily point to as uplifting, but Shaun of the Dead is a movie that makes me happy despite the fact that almost everyone in it dies horribly. again, it's the people who make it through, who get to be their best selves, who get to actualize. God, what else is there? There must be other movies that aren't this. Yeah, I turn to horror a lot as escape. I guess that's part of it, but I was always a big horror fan as a kid, and the ones where the threat feels real are the ones that feel the most exhilarating to me. Although, also, a lot of them end with everybody dying. So that means I should like Life is Beautiful more.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, some other things that I remember throughout the film that I kind of paid attention to as I watched it this last time around was just the use of color. I mean, the beginning of the film, you know, it starts off with that foggy scene and then it cuts to the big, bright, sunny southern Italy, or is it northern Italy? I don't know specifically where it takes place, but Italy, the countryside, is full of these gorgeous rolling hills and these tan architecture, and it's certainly contrasted with the dark and slimy and grimy Holocaust scene. So like visually, the palette is consistent for the film. It's
well, it's almost primary colors in the first hour, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, with all the flowers and beautiful
flowers, fruit, vegetables. There's always something in the corner of the frame that has a really pop that really brilliantly pops out and distracts us. And there's polka dots, things like that. Yeah. I mean, he goes for very simple, clear imagery, and then all the color just goes away, like almost immediately, right? As soon as they arrive,
as soon as they get on that train, and they're
that's true. It's before they get there. It's on the train. It's all like browns and grays.
Yeah. He bought the last two tickets for the train. Come on, there are no seats, but it's a fun ride. Yeah, I love how every aspect of dread was painted through that positive lens for his kids. So, and then there's a couple sour notes, you know, I'll admit them as well. Like when Guido's carrying this very heavy anvil, you know, that was his time to break down. He was away from his son, but he was still playing the clown to the other people in line with him. So I think that was the one sour note that that stuck out for me this time around. So I can admit the film's flaws as well. But it almost seemed at that moment where he's carrying this heavy anvil, he didn't need to put on a game for himself and the other people in the concentration camp, you know.
Yeah, well, and that's again one of the things that just made me wonder if perhaps Benigni hadn't thought it through as well. I mean, there are scenes that we see that the child just wouldn't know about. There's material where, you know, it's not that the film has to be airtight, that the illusion has to be airtight. Kids are dumb and they believe what you tell them. But the filmmaking. I don't know. It felt like there were so many points in the film where it just felt like showiness, like the flourish of a director who really wants you to see what he's doing.
So emotional manipulation, that sort of thing? Like,
overtly, emotionally, but also just in terms of, that's the scene with the bodies it's beautifully photographed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks really nice, which is probably not what you want from a pile of bodies, but you know, it's the, did you notice what I was doing with the fog? Did you see what my cinematographer is capable of? Things like that, which it didn't pull me out of the movie because I was already braced for it since I'd seen it. The film opens with this image or a version of it. Mm-hmm. And it just, I don't know. I guess at that point I was already looking for problems. So that's the other thing. I had checked out emotionally, I think, by that point. And I do wonder if, had I not met him years earlier, and also realize that his English is a lot better than it is when he's performing in front of an interview camera, where he's just putting on this, that thing extends. Yeah. And I think it's just, he's a people pleaser and he wants to give people the thing that they want. And I get it. But I wonder if I would be less cynical about this particular film if I hadn't actually had the experience of spending half an hour with him and Brashi, just
fascinating,
seeing who they are. She's nice. He's fine. I mean, he's not a bad person or anything, but I do think that, yeah, like he found something successful and really leaned into it, and then it took him somewhere that I don't know that the persona was strong enough to support. Sure. But that I don't need to denigrate the accomplishments of everyone else who worked on the film and all the things that it does fairly well.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, so if the actors were swapped, then perhaps it might have had a different effect on you.
Quite possible.
Yeah,
I'm open to that.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean,
that's allowed. You're allowed to do that. Okay.
I mean, this hypothetical, who else would you cast? Like, what actor in 1999 or even now could do that sort of thing without becoming maudlin or really, really obnoxious? The only person I can think of for an American remake, and, you know, they had Jacob the Liar with Robin Williams, which does not work because Williams was in that weird needy place where, like, not even Benigni goes there, where he's just so desperate to be loved by the audience that he takes roles like this, and then,
right,
you know, Robin Williams as a dramatic actor could be incredibly great and hyper laser focused, you know, like Good Will Hunting or Good Morning Vietnam or Dead Poets Society. He could be terrific, but he needed directors who would sit on his chest and make him, you know, normalize his performance rather than just that little bit of bigness and desperation behind his eyes that you can sometimes see. Jacob the Liar absolutely did that. I thought of Downey. Like, Robert Downey Jr., maybe, especially in 1999 as a young man, maybe. But I don't know. Even then, I'm not sure. Now I have no idea.
Have I seen him smile before? Like, Downey's very straight-faced, and he's got a huge chip on his shoulder. I don't know if he could pull off that joyous, maybe in his own way.
Yeah, it would look frantic, right? Like, it would look, you'd see the desperation.
Yeah. But could this be remade into like a Hollywood film? Like, I don't think you'd have that same, I don't know, that.
Yeah, I wonder. There's probably a way to do it that makes it a metaphor, that takes it away from the Holocaust entirely.
Right.
You know, that you could do a Gattaca version of this.
Sure.
Where everything is stylized and intellectualized out of relevance, I guess.
Yeah, out of a time in history. Sure, I see what you're saying.
I mean, in a weird way, there's probably, like, Terrence Malick's The Hidden Life is almost kind of about this. It's the same sort of thing where the world is insane and you're the only person in there. You're the only person who's principled and trying to stand up to, or trying to maintain your sense of reality. I mean, that's a really weird leap, and I don't think it works at all beyond the immediate thought, but weirdly, that's what came to mind.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I watched the film with my family the other night. My 10-year-old watched it for the first. It was her first foreign film, so she seemed to just not even notice the subtitles. So I think that was a good sign of introducing her to films from other countries. So it was nice to experience the viewing of the film through that lens as well. And I was just trying to pay attention of where my wife and my daughter responded to the film. They love the fact that. That young Joshua at the beginning is introduced holding a tank, and that was his number one toy. He wanted everything. He wanted so much to experience a real tank, and at the end of the film, he finally gets that when the American soldier picks him up after the war has ended and the Nazis have all left, and this large tank just rolls in, and the young boy's face lights up, and I think that was the moment where. You know, my daughter lost it as well when she saw the sacrifice that the father made and the reaction that the kid actually got the 1,000-point prize. So
I did find myself wondering if they let him keep it.
Yeah,
I mean, it's gonna suck for him eventually. Like that's the other thing that the film just isn't willing to show us is that the scene where the GIs tell him he can't keep the tank.
Yeah.
But maybe it's parked somewhere and he can go visit it on weekends.
Yeah, and it's and I'm pretty sure I was looking at some like historical facts about the Holocaust, and it wasn't the Americans who rolled in and liberated it was the Russians, right? That was the part of the history the Russians, that I read.
I think the Russians got to most of the camps first, although there were a couple of American platoons that liberated some in the westernmost camps. But yeah, it's, again, you have to, he's going with what he thinks people know, right? Like he's going with what the most familiar points are, which is reasonable. I mean, it's a fictional film. You can you can take liberties. I mean, Taika Waititi has Americans arriving in Berlin in Jojo Rabbit. Although I do think that's what happens. I think the Russians were still on their way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, Jojo Rabbit's another one where
I was just going to say that.
You know, you could make the charge that it creates a comforting fantasy, but I think the film is, I don't know, I find it much more powerful. Partially because we have the device of having Hitler in the film, and the thing that, like, the people who don't like Jojo Rabbit give the film no credit for whatsoever, but it's Waititi modulating his performance as Jojo learns more about the Nazis, and having Hitler go from a goofy best friend to a screaming bully as Jojo understands that, and the other parallel tracks of him learning more, which is the thing that Life is Beautiful just doesn't have. No one ever learns what's happening. Mm-hmm. The whole point of it is that Guido has to keep the secret and enlist other people in it. And so you're just denied the possibility of the real darkness, which I guess is part of the movie's appeal. It's a Holocaust movie that doesn't confront the horror. But I think that's what put me off. I think maybe you could make this movie... Well, I was going to say maybe you could make it before, but not after Schindler's List, but obviously he did, so that's not something I can say. But I think if I'd seen it before the wave of more graphic and confrontational films, or even before the documentaries started coming out, then maybe. But, I don't know.
That's fine.
I couldn't do it.
Are you familiar where the title comes from, at least? Like, Life is Beautiful, and the story behind that
particular phrase? La Vita è Bella? No, I guess. I'm not sure I am.
It's through Trotsky. So Trotsky was he knew of his impending death through Stalin. Stalin was after him at the time, and he was either going to die of his own, either being caught by Stalin and executed, or... He was in a place where he knew his death was impending, so he wrote a couple of lines that would be published posthumously, and he wrote something like, "Life is beautiful. Let the future generations cleanse it of all evil, oppression, and violence, and enjoy it to the full." So it's a phrase from a man who knew he was about to die at the hands of an oppressor. So I love that, how that was taken from that part in history and made it into the film.
It's a pretty eloquent epigram.
So now your whole view on the film has changed.
Well, I mean, I'm willing to consider it a little further.
And the whole Chaplin-esque thing with Benigni, is that a turn on or a turn off to you?
Well, I mean, again, it felt to me like he was trying for that reflected glory thing, because Chaplin made The Great Dictator. And you know, say what you will about the ending of that film, which just turns into a speech, but still lands. Mm-hmm. It does feel like, and this is what I was saying at the beginning, it felt like after making a movie about a mobster and a movie about a sex murderer, where else do you go to find something horrible to inject sweetness into? And The Great Dictator is a great example of resistance in cinema, because it was produced before people knew the full horror. It was produced before America even entered the war. It was a statement of purpose from an artist who decided that it would be really funny to piss Hitler off. Mm-hmm. And this feels like Benigni literally deciding he wants to be Chaplin and to do that. And then he decided he wanted to be Disney and make Pinocchio. And that doesn't work at all.
That didn't work out well. No.
But you know, you see that in the blank check form, right? The idea that you've made this movie, you've won an Oscar for it, two Oscars, I think. You can do whatever you afford to win score as well. But you've made this film that's critically acclaimed, for the most part, and it's financially successful, and it's won awards, and it's your turn to do the thing you want to do. And he went and made maybe the worst adaptation of Pinocchio I've ever seen, because he wanted to play the role himself.
Yeah.
And a balding 50-year-old Italian man in short pants running around screaming is terrifying, not adorable. And the fact that he didn't understand that he didn't realize it wouldn't work. And then, you know, I don't know if you've seen the Breckenmeyer dub version that Miramax released, where they released an English language dub where Breckenmeyer voiced Benigni. And I would love to sit Breckenmeyer down and talk about that someday, because his solution to how do you voice this character is fascinating, because it's inhuman.
Yeah.
It's worse. It's actually worse than the dub than the original Italian voice that Benigni supplies, because Meyer is trying to find a visual, an audio analog to the visual thing of this man jumping up and down and flailing, and it's just it's hypnotic, but it is terrible.
After that Pinocchio debacle, I can't remember the last thing Benigni was in. Where has he surfaced since?
He showed up in something. What was it? I'm just going to stop and look it up, because otherwise I will just stammer my way through it. Oh yeah, here it is. The Tiger in the Snow. Which is
that didn't
another.
Do too well either.
He directed it, and again, it's him choosing something really terrible to make a romance out of, because it's set during the invasion of Iraq, and he's a wacky Italian poet who falls in love and gets trapped in the middle, and you know, by this point, the device. I'm back thinking about the thing he told me in 1993, I guess, which is that he makes movies where the audience wants to see him fall in love with Nicoletta, and that is what happens. And that's true. That happens in all of them, except Pinocchio, where she plays the Blue Fairy. And by this point, it's just like all he's ever done is redress the set. Like he's taken the basic premise. And in Life is Beautiful, by having the romance be the least important thing about the movie, that's actually smart and clever. And then he just went right back to the same structure you know, we fall in love amidst blank. It becomes like a Mad Libs game that he's playing with himself, and it's just less interesting to me.
What you're saying kind of reminds me of one of the riddles in the film. So, you know, the German doctor says, if you speak my name, I vanish. What am I? And the answer is silence. So Benigni and this doctor, this German doctor, are always playing a riddle game. So that reminds me, like, Benigni, the actor, is doing all these grandiose projects to make him stand at the center of the film and lay it all on his shoulders. You know, if you speak his name too much, he's going to vanish himself, and that seems like what he did.
I wonder. He's apparently playing Geppetto in a new production of Pinocchio.
Oh, he loves that story, doesn't he?
Wow. Yeah, I can actually see that working. He has the right energy for Geppetto, especially now that he is older.
Yeah,
I mean, he's got to be pushing 70. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, he was born in the 50s, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. I would be willing to watch that.
Okay, good.
So there you go. You brought me around.
Yeah, and having shot a film in Italy recently, like, I mean, I know that the actors love to communicate with their hands, and they're very impassioned when they speak. Everything's very fast, and it's very much of a ping pong back and forth between talking to Italians and non-Italians, or trying to figure each other out, but they do it much more passionately and with their hands and physically. So I can understand, like, you know, if you don't come from that Italian heritage, like I do, like, it may be difficult to get in the mindset of watching someone like Benigni portray like an Italian on screen. That's just the way they communicate. Not so much the neorealist films in the 40s, but certainly the Italians of today love to get their point across in the most flourishy type of way possible.
Yes, gesticulatory, I think, is how I've heard it said, which sounds great. Yeah. But to that end, I mean, you've shot a film in Italy. You've made a number of features. Is there anything from Life is Beautiful that you have borrowed or stolen or lifted or just full-on homaged? Is there something that stuck with you there?
No, I can't see any necessarily themes that resonate between the two films. I mean, other than the importance of family to get through a challenging time. But that's just a very, I'm trying to grasping at straws for similarities. But no, I mean, the anywhere you point a camera in Italy is going to look gorgeous. No disrespect to our cinematographer who did an amazing job, but Italy is just a painting everywhere you look at it, or everywhere you point the camera. And so, yeah, making use of the natural landscape for those pops of color and the sun and the perfect light. So, yeah, those are the elements that I took with. And using and the importance of music. Obviously, Italy has a huge tradition of great music coming out of their composers. And, you know, our film being a co-production between Canada and Italy, that's what co-productions are. It's a natural split of labor between two countries to make one singular product. And and working with an Italian composer. And our film is about wine, and he used wine bottles and tapped bottles for the melody and to create a beautiful melodic sound using wine and using bottles and shaking them to use the make a percussion sound. So it was a really cool way to experience, put a little flavor of Italy in the sonic appearance in the film as well.
Nice. And I was thinking about Kiss and Cry, which sort of plays a similar trick on an audience, that Life is Beautiful plays on the characters, where the reality that we've been watching is actually more real than we're led to believe. And I don't want to get into it because I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen the film, but you took a very simple biographical story and added something from the beginning. It's there the whole time. We just don't know it. That is utterly devastating. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember watching the film and just gasping at the audacity, and that it worked is even better. So people listening to this should really just stop, go see it. We won't discuss it. I don't want to ruin it. But it's the same kind of daring to me as I'm going to make a love story about the Holocaust. It's like, it doesn't connect, but it does. You know what I mean? I was just wondering if maybe somehow Life is Beautiful prepared you for that kind of conceptual leap, which, you know, you knew it could be done if you committed.
Well, now
this is what I do. I just, you know, I wonderful. Pull stuff.
Yeah, no. And as we've just, you know, spent the last hour talking about this, the film, Life is Beautiful. Yeah, I can kind of see the parallels more in that film than the one I shot in Italy for sure.
Yeah. Maybe just put you on course.
Yeah. Now it's like when you, you're told a secret, like a family secret that you haven't heard ever, and now you're trying to process that. And so you've just done that to me. Now I got to sit back and think about, any other parallels from film history that I've kind of put in my other projects as well. I love hearing cool. other people talk about projects and how it makes you think back and over the course of your life as well, and what little things that happened in your life to put into your film. So. Yeah, thank you for that bit of personal psychology here.
My thanks to Sean Cisterna, whose new movie, From the Vine, is available this Friday, July 10th, on digital and on demand. And take the time to check out Kiss and Cry, which is streaming on Netflix. Oh, and so is Full Out. You can find Sean on Twitter at Sean Cisterna, all one word, and you can find Life is Beautiful on Blu-ray and DVD from Lionsgate in the US and Alliance in Canada. It's also available on Apple TV, because that's what we call iTunes now, and streaming free on Hoopla. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com, where I'm hosting a bunch of podcasts these days in addition to my film writing duties. Check them out. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it or the show, say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps, it truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. I've been catching up to Hot Plate, Mirella Amato and Joshna Maharaj's podcast about the landscape of food and drink, and it's pretty good. Stay inside, watch movies, wear a mask if you go out. I'll see you next week.